Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens here in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show brings the culture to horticulture.
Yes.
So we survived. Yay! I got it right. We survived up here some hurricanes. It's been a crazy couple of weeks.
Yeah, yes.
And I just want to extend our love for all the plants people that are down in Florida.
Yeah.
And for all the work that they do for us so that we can enjoy some beautiful tropical plants.
Yeah.
And we want to know how we can help. So please reach out to us and let us know. And I think we'd like to also do a shout out to our friend in Vallecas, Scott Appel.
Yes, Scott has been on the show many times.
Yeah,
been a really long time friend of ours, and I got in touch with him right before Irma hit, and Irma kind of skirted Puerto Rico, but they still lost power, and it was pretty rough. He asked me if FEMA would cover losses to plants.
Yeah.
I said, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think that's on the list
that's
of necessities.
On their list.
Unfortunately. Yeah. But Puerto Rico looks like it's going to be right in the eye
of Jose.
No, of Maria.
Of Maria.
Maria
right.
is right behind Jose.
I can't even keep up with them.
I know.
It's like every 3 days.
So this is like biblical. It's getting more biblical. It's like Mary, Joseph.
And who says that climate is not an issue? It's just unbelievable.
It's crazy. So we hope that you're safe, Scott. I'm going to try to reach out to you tonight, but if I don't get to you,
we're wrapping you in a big leaf.
A bubbly, soft leaf.
Yeah.
And I hope that you and the dogs and Bill are okay.
Yeah, and all of our friends, you know, all those palm tree nurseries and all the tropical
Bromelias
nurseries. Yeah,
so much comes from that area. So,
but
we're going somewhere a lot colder today than Florida or Puerto Rico.
Yeah. So, as you all know, hopefully you've been listening. We've been doing a theme this year: land and climate. Our zone today is Zone 4, which spans from Maine to Upper Vermont and New Hampshire, Northern Michigan, Wisconsin, Minneapolis, Fargo, Bismarck, Billings, and and Helena, Montana, Idaho, and all the way up to Anchorage, Alaska. So this is a huge zone.
Yeah.
And on each show, we are talking to gardeners and farmers, extension agents, botanists, writers, and growers who reflect new, unique, and relevant ideas for each zone. So we're really combining all of the American zones to over this year to do a really nice kind of panorama of horticulture in the United States. We're going to share their stories with you, listener, each month. and on our blog, and hopefully create a little zone envy in the process and an awareness of what gardeners go through in other zones. So this zone map, the USDA zone map, is what growers, gardeners, and anyone working in horticulture uses to determine what can grow where. It's a guide to your patch of earth. So when you buy a plant, it often lists its hardiness zone to help you decide if you can grow it where you live or if you need to bring it indoors for the winter. So zone four, my first intellectual experience with this landscape in zone four comes from the book My Antonia by Willa Cather, which is part of the Prairie trilogy, in which a young Bohemian girl comes of age during the end of the 19th century in the stark, dry, and harsh Nebraska landscape. It is cold and windy, the winters are harsh, and then they have these extremely dry, hot, windy summers. The setting is perfect for the exploration of American identity and growth. My first physical experience with this landscape and with this zone came from time spent in northern Michigan with my cousins, exploring the hot, dry fields of Queen Anne's lace and milkweed, and a very unfortunate run-in with poison sumac, wherein my body swelled up to about three times its mass, and it was determined that I have a terrible allergy to poison sumac, oak, and ivy.
Wow.
So, harsh, dry, and at the same time beautiful and life-changing. I will never sit among sumac ever again.
Can you eat it, Alice? Can you eat it as a powder?
I cannot even be around it.
Wow.
It
so is, you can't have that za'atar stuff that's in Persian cuisine.
No. It's wow. really, really horrible. So zone four to me represents the prairie and the settlement of the Western Plain and the birth of the ecology movement in the 1970s with one of my favorite books, The Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, who coined the term land ethic. So in the 70s, when I was a little girl, itching and scratching from my sumac poisoning, I began to be very aware of the environment and our responsibility to the environment. So this term land ethic was a big deal for me, and it was a responsibility that we have as humans. Aldo Leopold says, "We can only be ethical in relation to something we can see, understand, feel, love, or otherwise have faith in, or scratch."
Right. Or cause
in
you
my
pain.
Case, yes. Right. So I just find it really interesting that My Antonia, this beautiful story,
great book. Alice, you introduced me to it,
is all about. I mean, it's the story of this young Bohemian immigrant girl, but you know, she's coming of age, and the landscape is such a huge, helpful part of her identity, and it's windy and hot and terrible and cold and lovely all at the same time. So zone four, right? We're going to talk about it. It is massive.
And cold.
And cold.
And how cold is it?
Oh, so cold. How cold is it?
Let me tell you how cold it is. Zone four gets to, on average, between negative 30 to negative 20 Fahrenheit.
Oh, is that all?
Oh, that's nothing. My husband went to the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and he always said to me, I used to say, do they close the school when it gets that cold? And he said, it has to be negative 35 or below. They do not close the
school. So there's no whining in your house.
There's no whining in about cold.
And he grew up in Kansas.
Yeah. So he can take the heat
the
and
heat
the cold.
The heat and the cold, yeah.
Yeah. And we've talked about the prairie a lot on this show. We both really love it.
Yeah. So we have an amazing guest today to help us understand what this ethic idea is. It's plantsman Neil Dibble.
Let me tell you about Neil. Neil is a pioneer in every sense of the word. He is the owner and founder of the Native Plant Nursery, Prairie Nursery in Wisconsin. He is a pioneer in the native plant industry generally and recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. Neil Dibble has guided the growth of Prairie Nursery in Wisconsin for 30 years. He has dedicated his life to the propagation of native plants and their promotion as uniquely beautiful, ecological, beneficial, and sustainable solutions for landscapes and gardens. In 2013, Neil was the recipient of the Great American Gardeners Award from the American Horticultural Society. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Hi, thanks for joining us. So tell us a little bit about how you got to the Prairie Nursery, your studies and the original backyard prairie garden.
Well, like all things in life, good and bad, you blame it on your parents.
True.
I agree.
So when we were kids, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and we would go on wildflower hikes and camping trips. So we'd go down to the Ozarks, and of course we had to go on the required wildflower hikes.
Yep.
And my mother's family is from Western Colorado, and so we'd be in the camping in the mountains in the summers, and of course there were many more wildflower hikes to be had, which were all well and good, but it wasn't what, you know, young kid wanted to do. He wanted to go throw bottles in the lake and throw rocks at them. You know?
Right, so, right.
But that rubbed off big time. And when I went to college, I thought I was going to be an environmental engineer and save the world. And then I realized I really don't like calculus. Okay, what else is there? And then really gravitated back to my roots and started taking classes in ecology and biology and botany.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out in a prairie remnant with a friend of mine and saw prairie blazing star, Liatris pycnostachya, for the first time, and I said, oh my God, what a beautiful plant. And that started the whole thing. I got addicted. I got hooked. So that was my entry-level drug plant, prairie blazing star.
That's a good one, right.
So I just started studying prairies at school and did projects on it at the university. I went to University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, which in the 1970s had, beyond a doubt, the finest integrated interdisciplinary environmental sciences program in the world. It was copied by Oxford, Harvard, and various other universities around the world. And it was really a wonderful experience, and there with lots of people who were very environmentally oriented and part of the whole environmental movement. Very exciting time. So that just led to recalibrating what I wanted to do in life, and I realized, you know what, it all starts with a healthy environment, so I'm going to help people have healthy environments. That's something I can control. I can't change the direction of the world, but at least I can do something to help people do their little thing to change
right.
the direction.
Right. So tell us about the origins of the Prairie Nursery.
Well, the Prairie Nursery, actually, I did not start it. It was started by a gentleman named Bob Smith, who started it quite by accident, because he bought this old rundown farm in central Wisconsin in the Sand Counties, not far from where Aldo Leopold's shack was. In fact, he worked with Aldo Leopold back mm-hmm. in the 30s and 40s because he was involved in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Bob Smith was. And he saw butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa, growing alongside the road, this little country road that his farm was on.
Right.
He said, gee, that's a beautiful flower. I'd like to grow that. And he just put some seeds in the ground in the fall with next to his, you know, in his vegetable garden. And lo and behold, they germinated the next year, and he had plants. So then he started growing other prairie flowers. And then after a few years, somebody asked him, would you sell us some flowers and plants? He says, sure. And that's how Prairie Nursery was born, quite by accident.
Okay. And how did you come to the nursery?
Well, I was Bob Smith's best customer because I bought seeds for restoration at the Arboretum at UW Green Bay that I managed. And so I knew of him. I never met him, but I would call him on the phone. That was in the days before email. And I heard that he's 68, and he said, this is too much work. I'm going to get out of this business. So I called him up and said, gee, Bob, would it be okay if I bought your plants and moved them up here to Green Bay? I've got a couple acres I can grow these on. And he said, well, I suppose, but maybe you should come down to Westfield and take over the nursery. Of course, I was floored. Where is Westfield, a town of 1,100 people?
Right.
Okay.
It's in the West Field.
Exactly. So I went down there, took a look at it, said, you know what? If I don't do this, I will kick myself for the rest of my life. I'm going to give it a try.
Yeah.
That's how I got involved.
Yeah.
And that was actually now 35 years ago, 1982.
Wow. So tell us about the native seed and the ecology idea and the relationship between seeds and ecology in a nutshell. I know this is like a PhD, but
Okay. Well, you've opened up quite an acorn there. But what we try and do here is that we grow plants and we grow seeds and we ship them to our customers. And we have, although I was seduced greatly in the 1990s with plant selections, and I made some really beautiful selections of native plants, I decided that is not the direction that we would go as a nursery, because our whole foundation is the concept of biodiversity. And by maintaining as diverse a gene pool as possible of your plant material, you theoretically have more adaptable plants. Rather than a clone of one single variety, you have at least some subsection of a species gene pool that has the diversity to be adaptable to changing climate, changing all sorts of changing conditions. So that's what we've stuck with. And so almost all of our plants are grown from seed. There are a few that are difficult to do from seed, like the phlox, which have exploding seeds. So we do those by division, by cuttings. And then a few other species that we do by root divisions, but we base the stock plants on at least three different populations of that species, so we have some genetic diversity therein.
Do you do breeding as well, Neil, or do you stick?
I used to, but that's not really what we do.
Right.
Only real breeding I've done is taken some Zone 6 plants from Ohio and basically just brute force bred them by selection for cold hardiness to Zone 4 by just basically subjecting them to torture, and okay, this Zone 6 plant will now grow in Zone 4. Oops, only 20% live. Too bad. Well, take sorry about that, guys. The survivors, and you just, after 5 or 6 generations, you take the seeds from the survivors, and now you've got a 98% cold hardy plant. Really, really not very ingenious.
But
effective.
What is your best selling plant at the nursery?
Our two best selling plants are Little Bluestem, Schizocarium scoparium, a short prairie grass, and Prairie Drop Seeds, Parabolus heterolepis. And these are really the foundation of most native meadow or prairie gardens in the eastern half of the United States, because they're low-growing, they're absolutely beautiful plants, and they mix well with the various wildflowers. They don't get too tall, they're not too aggressive, they're both clump formers, so they don't try and take over the world with rhizomes. So those are far and away our two very best-selling plants.
We use those.
Yeah.
We've made mini prairies in Manhattan, Neil.
On rooftops, yes.
So, and tell us about your customers.
Yeah.
So you have is it a retail nursery that people can come to, or is it strictly mail order, Neil?
We are strictly mail order, internet.
Okay.
It's interesting. You know, it's interesting you asked that. In 1982, we really were a mail order. We would go to the post office every day and see, oh, my God, how many orders did we get? And they all in the mail.
Yeah.
And then things evolved towards 800 number. We got our 800 number probably, I think, in the early 90s.
Right.
And then things migrated to mail order, phone orders. And now 80% of our orders come in on the web.
Sure. And are they, you deal with individuals, but you also, I'm sure, deal with institutions. And do you ship internationally, too? Or are your seeds, like, spreading beyond the United States?
That's a personal question, Carmen.
Boy. I wasn't prepared for these,
racy,
these probing personal questions.
Well, you never know with the two ladies of We Dig Plants, because we throw a few curveballs once in a while. So if you're not too uncomfortable talking about this.
About your seed distribution.
Or plants.
Well, our focus is really on regional ecology of the upper Midwest.
Right.
So that's where the vast majority of our customers are, because that's where these plants are and the gene pools of these plants are originally native to.
But
we do have customers east of us and west of us and south of us. We don't really recommend our plant material for south of the Mason-Dixon line, because it's a completely, utterly different growing environment.
Sure.
And really not recommended.
Right.
So if you're in a similar ecoregion that has similar rainfall, similar light patterns as far as latitude, north to south, you can usually have very good results with these plants, even if they're not directly in Wisconsin or Minnesota or Michigan. The only real shipping we do internationally is to botanic gardens, where they want to have examples of an American prairie.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if that was happening, because it's so, you know, what's happened with the High Line in New York.
It's so hot.
It's very hot to have this feeling, you know,
yeah.
In other of the prairie and other places, you know.
So, yeah, it's very interesting because in Germany there's a huge interest in meadows, and also in England as well.
Right.
So in fact, I was visiting a friend of mine, Dr. James Hitchmo, who did the Olympic Gardens in London. And this was 20 years ago, and he's showing me his native English meadows at the University of Sheffield, and I'm looking at these plants and and he looks at me like, you don't seem to be very impressed. I said, well, I'm sorry, James, but all these plants are weeds in America.
Right, right.
Because that's what they had to work with. But there is a very definite, you know, when your whole island is scraped clean by a glacier only 13, 14,000 years ago, it leaves very limited amount of material to repopulate it with over there.
And when you have the largest, when you had the largest naval military and exploration funding, you know, you just brought everything back.
From everywhere else, yeah.
All the weeds.
That's what they did.
Yeah.
That's why they went all around the world and expropriated plants, because we have nothing here. We have to get all this other cool stuff.
Right.
And where has it, I'm curious, Neil, where has it been successful? Like, what botanical garden, for example, has had a successful sort of American transplant prairie that you can think of?
England is difficult because it's so cold, and only in the southern portions, like Dover and those areas, can they have success with prairie. But in Germany, especially southern Germany, there have been a number of prairie gardens. There is a botanic garden in Weinheim that has been very successful, and they have very sandy soil, and they maintain and create zones with rocks and sand to make it for good drainage and warm soil conditions. So they've had some very interesting and very diverse prairie plantings, because the curator there is really, really adept and an extraordinarily good gardener and an unbelievably good plantsman. So Cassian Schmidt in Weinheim, just south of Frankfurt, has an amazing prairie garden.
Oh, that's great. It's good to know where else people can get a taste of American.
Well, I mean, all of Pete Odoff's work and Noel Kingsbury, their work. I mean, if one more person says to us, Neil, I want my garden to look like the High Line, I'm going to die. Like, I'm just going to die. And you know what? Pete's plants are beautiful, but they're not readily available in commerce. Yeah. And it's very difficult. So we buy a lot, and we work a lot with Claudia West. And she does some great work. But, you know, it's very hard, because the High Line also has a team of gardeners there every day, all day, to make it look exactly that way. And a prairie doesn't look that way. You know,
it's
not that curated.
Right. That's the irony of these, like, uber precious overly designed gardens. And yes, they're beautiful to walk through, but ecologically they're not what the prairie is.
No, what Piet has done here, and he's an absolute genius plantsman and designer, but he's achieved a compromise between the wild and the cultivated, and what the human eye perceives as attractive.
Yes.
And in a native prairie, many people consider it weedy because it's chaotic. It's this conglomeration of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different grasses and 20, 30, 40 or more flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't read to the human eye, because people don't necessarily understand the ecological power of a biodiverse ecosystem that's does not have allocated zones and groupings and clumpings of certain species to make it attractive to the human eye.
Right.
So that's always an issue. And it's very interesting to me that this whole prairie movement started in Wisconsin in the 1930s with the reconstruction of the first native prairie at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. And Aldo Leopold was involved in that process at that time, along with many other people who did a tremendous amount of work on it. And that was the original concept of recreating an ecological community. Nobody had ever really done that. And this was a completely and utterly radical concept, because we make gardens. We don't make, you know, these communities that we plowed up to plant corn and beans and hay and wheat. This has no value because they're wild plants. But they saw the value of a relatively intact, diverse native plant community.
So let's talk. This is opening up that big acorn again. Let's talk about the prairie and our environment to American history. Because when you think of America, you think of the prairie, right? It's the identifying
the open space,
landscape.
The openness.
Right. So tell us about that ecology and why that's particularly American.
You know, this is a fascinating topic. And if you look at the world's grasslands, the North American prairie, which stretched from Texas all the way into Manitoba, you have similar ecosystems in Africa, the savannas and the velds of South Africa and the savannas of Central Africa. And then you have the steppes of Asia and also Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these grassland ecosystems that have evolved over millions and millions of years. But the North American prairie is the only one that we've had, in Africa, we also have had that, the opportunity to historically document from its quote-unquote undisturbed state prior to the population by Euro-Americans from Europe. So we have botanic records of these original prairies. But what's really interesting is if you have no disturbance, an ecological disturbance, which would include fire, ice storms, wind, grazing, plowing, something to disturb the ecosystem, the North American prairie does not naturally dominate east of central Kansas because it's too moist and it's not capable of preventing trees and shrubs from invading the prairie.
Mm-hmm.
So why in the world were these huge prairies that extended all the way to Ohio, all the way into Pennsylvania, even to Long Island? Yes. Have you ever been to Hempstead Plain in Long Island?
Sure.
It's a prairie.
Yeah.
Sure. That was probably a remnant of the xerothermic period approximately 13,000 years ago. 7,000, it depends on where it was. It was after the glacial retreat. Excuse me, that was about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, I think. But you also had a very important factor, and that was Native Americans, because they burned the prairies, they burned down the forest, and they did it very intentionally. It was not just because they like to see things burn, as many of us do. It was intentional land management and economic decision. Because if you have a hunter-gatherer economy, which most of these societies did, you need to have efficient hunting. And what is efficient hunting? In the forest, what are you going to get? You're going to get a squirrel. You know, there's not a lot of big game. Occasional deer, but deer are really an edge species at the edge of the forest and the meadow.
Mm-hmm.
If you want big hunks of meat, you want a bison or an elk, something that eats grass and lives in the open in the prairie. So they intentionally burned huge swaths of land to keep trees and shrubs out to make proper habitat so they could have good hunting. And so this was an economic land management decision that was affecting huge areas of the central North American continent.
Mm-hmm.
90% of Iowa's prairie, 40% of Missouri, 70% of Illinois, a huge swath of this land was prairie where normally trees would naturally dominate.
That's fascinating. I didn't know how much the native peoples managed it, you know,
right,
and really created it.
Right.
You know,
it was a co-evolutionary existence between the native peoples and all the elements of the ecosystem, the plants and the animals.
You guys still do some burning, right? Some guarded burning up there to manage. Like, I know at the Leopold Society, I think they do some burns.
Oh, yeah.
Scheduled burns, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Burning is, I mean, we recommend to everybody, if they can, to burn their prairie because that is the most efficient and cost-effective way to manage your prairie. And it's the most fun method as well, as long as you're properly prepared.
Yeah. So, I'd like to see that in New York.
Yeah, I would love
some of these uberly designed.
I had a client in Westchester, and she had to jump through 80,000 hoops before she could burn her prairie. She finally got permission.
Ah, in Westchester, New York.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, in Pound Ridge.
In Pound Ridge, so, right.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Neil, about how the fires work. How do you prevent it from, you know, getting out of control?
That's a really good question. When we design a prairie for a client, we make sure we build in fire breaks.
Okay. Okay.
So if we have a natural fire break, like a road or a driveway or a big river or a lake, or a mowed lawn makes a great fire break.
Okay.
So, but if we have an edge between a prairie and a woodland, we will seed a 15 to 20 foot wide strip of grass that we can mow, turf grass.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So then when it's time to burn, we have the fire breaks all in place, and you're not out there mowing the prairie back and raking off all this burnable, flammable material, which can take a crew hours and hours and hours to do. We have everything designed into place, so it is really designed to burn. And then, of course, you have to be very sensitive to the wind conditions, the sure. wind speed, temperature, relative humidity. Mm-hmm. Make sure you have a burn plan that makes sense, and you've got a trained crew, and you've got the proper equipment for fire suppression. But I do it at my house by myself. I get home from work. If the weather is right, I go out there with my little 3-foot little grass fire breaks and my backpack sprayer and a little rake and a flapper, which you know, is sufficient in a 1-acre prairie burn. But most people would probably want a little more fire break than that, but I've never lost a fire.
That's awesome.
And you can do many acres at a time, right? Is there a limit, like, or to the size of a fire you can? Are there regulations now, like in Wisconsin or in other areas about burning?
Yes, there are regulations depending upon where you live. Mm-hmm. For instance, where I live in central Wisconsin, which has drier, sandier soils, you're not allowed to burn until after 6 p.m. in the spring.
Okay.
In southeastern Wisconsin, where the soils are predominantly clay, hold more moisture. You can burn in the middle of the day, and sometimes they require you to burn in the day and not at night for some reason. Mm-hmm. So it all depends upon your region and your local laws and your local ecology, the local soils, and the chances of fires getting out of control.
Yeah.
But there are natural areas in the Midwest where you can have prairie burns of 100-plus acres up to 1,000-plus acres. And when you get out to Kansas, where you have, for instance, the Kansas Prairie near Manhattan, Kansas, and then you have the national grassland south of there in east central Kansas. They're burning huge, huge areas at once, but they have well-made fire breaks in place.
Yeah, I've been to both of those places. My husband's from Manhattan, Kansas, and it is so amazing. I've never been there when the burns were happening, which I assume is probably in the late winter. Is that right?
Yes, late winter, early spring, okay. and they are burning to optimize new growth of the grass for their cattle.
Yeah.
Or bison.
Pretty cool.
Right. All right. Stay on the line, Neil. We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the prairie and ecology. Thanks.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate. An incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today we are in Zone 4 in Wisconsin with Neil Dibble, and we're talking about the prairie and native plants and ecology. So, Neil, let's talk a little bit more in depth about how climate affects your industry and gardening in your zone. Can you go a little more into detail about the rainfall, the winter temperatures, wind, et cetera? How does that all play into your zone and your business there?
Well, to be honest with you, we have no idea what's going on here. We have had the most crazy weather. In 2008, we had extreme flooding.
Oh, God.
And we had 17 inches of rain in 6 days in my house, which compared to Houston is nothing when you look at that.
That's right.
When they had 50 inches in, 4 days?
And yeah.
Uh-huh. But we were actually trapped in our house because all the bridges, all the rivers were flooded, and we couldn't get off of our, we live on a hill, and we couldn't go anywhere for a couple of days because all the rivers had, had blocked the bridges. But, and then in 2012, we had the worst drought I've seen in my life. I thought the drought of 1988 was kind of the marker for me, and the drought of 76 was bad, but the drought of 36, now that was a really bad one. But, I remember that one. But,
well, you were just starting your business. Your business was fairly young when the big drought came, right?
Oh, yeah.
So...
Oh, yes. But, and prairie plants are amazing. I've seen them go through these extreme periods of drought, especially in 1988, but 2012 was far worse. And even the big, tall prairie grasses, like big blue stem and switchgrass, which never went dormant in 1988, they actually just abandoned their leaves, and many of the clumps, 50 to 80% of the clumps, just went brown in July.
Wow.
Yeah, these
wow.
plants have roots, you know, these plants have roots 6, 7, 8 feet deep.
That's apocalyptic.
Wow.
It really was horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of the prairie plants, they just go dormant. They say, we're done. We're out of here. We'll come back next year.
Yeah.
We're not going to put up with this.
Right.
They're perennials. The vast majority are perennials, so they can do that. The most amazing thing to me was the big blue stem, which was particularly affected by the drought of 2012. I thought, well, that's going to really knock it back next year in 2013.
Right.
In 2013, it grew more lushly and it produced more seed than I'd ever seen in my life after this drought experience. Like, what in the world? If you treat it poorly, it comes back even harder? I don't know.
It sounds like some of my ex-boyfriends.
Well, I guess if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger, right? you guys are great. So
anyway, back to plants.
And then the USDA is revising the hardiness zones, and suddenly we're not zone 4 anymore. We might be zone 5, and then we got the polar vortex in 2014.
Oh, God.
Which blasted everything, and I was like, oop, reset. We're back to zone 4A or 4B.
That was a horrible the word vortex, when that polar vortex came into vernacular.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so
into our everyday language.
Yeah, it was so disturbing, Neil, at every level.
Yeah.
Ugh. So then you went back to zone 4, and then what happened?
Yeah. We've just been kind of coasting along now with very mild winters now.
Yeah.
When I was a boy, I remember, we in Wisconsin, we would have weeks and months where the temperature did not go above freezing, and sometimes we'd have weeks where it did not go above zero.
Wow.
And we don't get anything like that anymore. I think last year we had 15 below in the middle of December, and that was it. And the rest was like palm trees.
Yeah. But,
what about precipitation? What about the precipitation these past couple of years? Have you noticed any changes in like the patterns in terms of amounts or seasonality of it?
Yes, according to our meteorological records, as of the end of July, it was the wettest year on record since they started keeping records, I think, in the 1870s.
Wow.
So, and that was until July. Now we've had some very dry weather the last month and a half, so it's probably going to equilibrate a little bit. But yes, it's been much damper. And the original global warming models that were first being released about 20 years ago indicated that eastern Wisconsin, strangely, would actually get cooler and have higher precipitation. And other parts of the state would also potentially have higher precipitation. And, of course, the entire model is when you're pumping more energy from the equatorial zones to the mid-latitudes, you're going to have increased precipitation of all types, just because there's more energy in the system, which allows the atmosphere to carry more moisture, and it was going to precipitate out as it goes north, which is pretty much consistent with what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty weird, but I guess I'd rather have more rain than less rain.
Yes.
If you're in a low-lying area and you filled in all your wetlands, and oh, wow, look what happened. We're all getting our houses flooded.
Yeah. And you're building on you know, sandbars, and you're filling in with cement where there should be canals, and, you know,
Exactly. And, you know, a strict laissez-faire capitalist would say, too bad. You don't build there. if you build there, you pay the price. But we have government insurance that allows people to continue building there, and taxpayers continually pay more money to bail them out.
Right.
Kind of stupid from an economic standpoint as well as an ecological standpoint.
Right.
And finally, some low-lying areas are actually being abandoned and returned to their natural riparian situation, which only makes sense.
Yeah, they were doing that after Sandy in New Jersey, and I think in some parts of New York along
and
the
Long
coast,
Island.
And Long
yeah.
Island, that's mm-hmm. the they had the wisdom to say, you know, we'll just buy your house and property, and you build somewhere else.
Right.
You know, it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's
cheaper.
Just
yeah.
cheaper.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
Right.
I mean, we're either building on wetlands or filling them with trash. Those are like the two kind of choices that we seem to have done, right? I mean, all
this,
of them.
This whole series of zones, it's been fascinating, yeah. but it's also, I feel like it's totally depressing because we're looking at the United States and all of this progress, and it's really just been the last 30, 40 years, you know? And so here's a question for you. What seeds do you not see that you wish you did see from your childhood, Neil?
Yeah, what plants?
What plants?
What mm-hmm. seeds and plants, yeah.
That's really not an issue.
Okay.
At all.
Well, that's
no,
encouraging.
What concerns me is the degradation of habitat and the decline of pollinators.
Okay.
Yeah.
And really, if you look at our progress since the 1960s, when the environmental movement really started to gather steam, mm-hmm. we have preserved so many species that were on the verge of extinction, like ospreys and bald eagles and sandhill cranes and all kinds of things that were in, I mean, charismatic megafauna that it would be a shame to lose. And they've been preserved. In fact, they're doing quite nicely, thank you very much. So we've had a lot of tremendous successes, but where we've really fallen down is in the little things. In the pollinators, and there's been just never-ending declines in these pollinators. And this is where native flowers, native trees, native shrubs that support these so important little guys are so critical. And I believe firmly that the future of ecology in our country and the world is not just in the government preserving land and nature conservancy preserving land, all of which is crucially and critically important,
sure.
but in individual homeowners and landowners planting native plants that support all the other pieces of the puzzle and not planting this stuff from around the world that does not have long-term coevolutionary relationships with our native flora, with our native fauna, which is so important. And I can't overstress the importance for people to read Doug Tallamy's book, mm-hmm. Bringing Nature Home.
Yeah.
Doug has hit a grand slam with his book, which is now must be, 10 years old, but it's timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the point that it is native plants that support native insects, and insects are the foundation of the food chain, and if we destroy the foundation of the food chain, we are not far behind.
And we see it at a small level here in New York. I mean, literally the day that we plant the grasses
yeah.
and the echinaceas and other natives in these small pocket, you know, gardens and even bigger green roofs and things, the pollinators come within minutes,
hours. Yeah, like they're there.
And that is one of the things that is most incredible to our clients. You mm-hmm. know, we tell them if you plant
like
them,
a moth to a flame,
they will come
yeah.
and they come.
Yeah.
You know,
but we need more of them.
Yeah.
They need to be in everyday life.
And bigger patches
yeah.
of it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that is why it's the responsibility of every homeowner, every landowner, every corporate steward, everybody to plant native trees, shrubs, flowers, grasses, sedges, everything that helps support all these other forms of life. Because we're all in this game together. We're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really realized it because it wasn't really that important or it wasn't really that critical. Well, it's getting more and more critical all the time. And these are very simple, easy steps to take. It's just decisions as far as what you plant in your landscape. Not mm-hmm. hard. Not hard.
Now, let me ask you this question. What do you think about this, you know, the invasive list, right? Like loosestrife and
Miscanthus,
and what do you think about these guys, these thugs?
This is what keeps me up at night. Really, I don't worry about the stock market. I worry about invasive plants because yeah. we're watching our public lands that have been supposedly preserved in perpetuity being completely invaded and biodiversity being gravely reduced by non-native invasive plants.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few native invasive plants. Let's not
right.
You know,
right.
There are some that are we're here and for some reason have taken up invasiveness, or they're inherently that way. But primarily, it is non-native invasive plants that really have no enemies here because they come from other ecosystems where there has not been time here for them to develop enemies that adapt to their special growing conditions or needs. So you have all these horrific plants invading our woodlands, invading our grasslands that are a real threat to biodiversity, really a huge threat. And there's no way that they can be controlled without a huge, huge effort and cost mm-hmm. to go out there and do it. And so I've just watched these beautiful natural areas be consumed by these invasive plants. So yeah, I think it's a terrible, terrible thing.
What's the one that you are most fearful of invading your property at the nursery?
Well, we bought a 20 acre buckthorn farm, and common buckthorn, Rhamnus cathartica, is a hugely invasive plant for us in our woodlands. And of that 20 acres, 15 of it was buckthorn, and I've cleared about 14 of the 15. I left a little screen down by the road. So that is a never-ending battle. Other people have problems with Tartarian honeysuckle in our region, Lanisa tartarica.
Mm-hmm.
Garlic mustard is a never-ending threat, Alliaria petiolata, that invades my woodlands, and it's a never-ending threat. I try and keep it under control, but it's indefatigable. And believe this, I just found growing on my property this year Japanese stilt grass, Microstegia viminium.
Now, where could that have come from?
That's God only knows.
Okay. It's wild.
Well, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, these plants, they move.
They move.
The animal, you know, birds transport them.
Yeah.
Even if they don't, they can get caught in the wing of a bird, and it travels 1,000 miles in a week.
Yeah.
All sorts of ways.
This weekend, I went hiking in the Palisades, which is this outcropping right across the Hudson River from New York City and on up, and the parkland was invaded with clematis.
Fall blooming.
Yeah, the fall. Yeah. It used to be called Maximosiana, but I think it's called Virginiana now. I don't know if they changed the name.
No, that's the non-invasive.
Native. That's the native.
Yeah. So yeah. This stuff was. I mean, it smelled incredible.
Yeah.
But it was covering everything.
Yeah.
Every
it's
inch.
It's the kudzu of the north.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. Yeah. You know, and I was blown away about how much.
Right.
It had covered this parkland.
Yeah,
you know,
it takes off. I found Oriental bittersweet on my property last fall.
Yeah.
That had never been there. So I got the buckthorn under control. Now there's 15 other guys want to get in.
Right.
Mess around.
Build a wall.
So, you know,
build a wall.
What's that?
Build a wall.
It's more like surrender, earthling. Resistance is futile.
Exactly. Right. True. Right. Right.
I had a feeling that if I stood on the trail long enough, the clematis would wrap around me
for sure.
Within the hour,
yeah.
And I would no longer make it
out. You'd be rooted forever. I'm sorry that we are approaching our deadline, so I just want to wrap up with a couple other questions. The plant that you cannot live without, and why?
Well, that's like picking your favorite kid out of a dozen.
Right.
I'll give you four plants.
Okay.
The aforementioned prairie blazing star, Liatris pycnostachya, which is just an absolutely gorgeous plant. And it just symbolizes the prairie to me. In the east, you have Liatris spicata, which is a very similar plant,
mm-hmm.
the marsh blazing star or dense blazing star. And then the grass, little blue stem.
Mm-hmm.
Which if you've ever seen a large prairie of little blue stem in the wind this time of year, September, October, it's just like the ocean. Waves blowing on across the fields to the horizon. Absolutely gorgeous. And then the bur oak, Quercus macrocarpa, which is this symbol of strength in adversity because it is the only tree that can invade and survive in a prairie that is being regularly burned, grazed, mowed, whatever. It will survive.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly beautiful tree, and it's fire resistant, smoke resistant, pollution resistant, drought resistant, disease resistant, amazing tree. And finally, the white pine, Pinus strobus, which is the majestic symbol of our Northwoods. And that's where the bald eagles usually will make their nests. And it's just an all-around fantastic beautiful tree.
And we'd love that.
You have just painted such a beautiful picture with those four plants.
Yeah. We love white pine, too. We use them because rooftops mimic, you know, beachy, windy environments, and they kind of do quite well there.
It's a tough tree. It's a tough customer.
Yeah. When we were just in, we were just up at Lake Winnipesaukee, and we saw bald eagles up in the white pine, and my son still is talking about it, you know, like 3 weeks later, about the bald eagle. And I just love that he's five and he has that image already in his brain, you know.
Yeah, well, such a beautiful area.
Yeah.
Neil, tell us, share your website and also with our listeners where how they can buy the plants, and also where you're going to be in the next few months. I know that you do some speaking.
Yeah, you have quite a speaking arrangement.
Yeah, if anybody would like to learn more about native plants that we offer and native plants in general, they can go to our website at prairienursery.com. That's P-R-A-I-R-I-E nursery, one word. Prairie is a French word, so none of us know how to spell it. And I tell people that we have three products: plants, seeds, and information.
Yes.
But without the information, you won't have nearly as good a results with the plants and seeds. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of information on there for people that would like to just get started and learn about it. And then I don't have a lot lined up for this fall, but I will be giving a lecture for the, you kind of caught me by surprise.
Sorry.
On schedules here. Let me see where I'm going to be when. I will be giving a lecture to the master gardeners who have really adopted native plants here in the last few years.
That's great.
On October the 5th in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. So that's Thursday, October 5th. And if you go to our website, there's information on this. If you go to Prairie Nursery in the right-hand corner and click on that, it will go down to my page, and that will list my lectures. And I've got a couple other coming up next spring, one in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, with the Wild Ones, which is a wonderful organization.
The Wild Ones.
Local chapter. The Wild Ones, yes. Started by Lori Otto from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she led the fight against DDT in the early 1960s and got DDT banned. And then she went on to establish the Wild Ones, which is a native landscaping group that has local chapters. And I would strongly encourage people to become involved with this group because they are wonderful.
Oh, I'm going to look
them
up.
Oh, that's cool.
Have you come out to New York at all, Neil, to speak?
It's been a long time. You know, it's interesting. 25 years ago, I had so many speaking engagements, but that's because I was one of the very few people doing this. So I was a bright, shiny new penny.
Right.
Now, people are doing this everywhere, which is fantastic. It means that we've been successful.
Yeah.
So you got lots of local experts that can do a great job. So they don't invite me anymore, but that's okay.
Well, you're invited. Come. Please come. Because I want to learn more about burning. That is really fascinating.
Yeah. Burning is fun.
Yeah.
Burning good. And you know, it used to be believed that the burning gene was only on the Y chromosome, but it's strongly associated with the X chromosome. There are many women burners here in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
Well, on that note, Neil, we're going to thank you for being on the show. And we put a link to your website on our Facebook page so people can just click on it and learn more. You have tons of information and great plants. And thank you so much for taking the
Thanks
time.
Thanks for sharing your information with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on my show. It's been absolutely great.
I also want to give a shout out to Chanticleer Garden. talk about landscapes and inspiration. Bill Thomas was on the show. It is an incredible garden. It closes for the season end of October.
Yeah.
And if you're in the general area of Pennsylvania, Philly, New York City, New Jersey, Delaware area, please go and take a look at it. It looks so incredible right now. Their tropical plants are still outside, and it will just blow your mind. So please check out Chanticleer in Wayne, Pennsylvania. You've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. You can check out our Facebook page. All of you know where to find us probably by now. next month, we're going to get even colder, right, and go to Zone 3.
Zone 3.
You can follow us on Instagram at We Dig Plants. Mm-hmm. And we Twitter. We do all kinds of stuff. So stay in touch with us. And please reach out if you have people that are in zones 1, 2, 3 and you think that we should have them on the show. Give us a shout out and maybe we'll have them on. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. See you in the virtual garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.